and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to a Sunday edition of the French Connection. Today's date is November 2nd, 2008. Of course, my name is Daryl Bradford Smith, and we are looking forward to another hour of these, of one of my important broadcasts here. This is a weekend edition. I am of a mind of late to ramp up some interviews and some informational rants that are going to be coming up over the next week or two, because let's face it, ladies and gentlemen, we're in the crunch time here. We're in the real difficult period. This election process is a nonsense. It's an absolute nonsense, especially when you look behind these candidates and who's really running their programs. Lots of things have been happening in the world financially, and I have done my best to predict for you and to give you a good understanding of just what to expect, how bad it's going to be, where it's going to take place, what kind of things you can do to help ameliorate the problems your family may face or your community, and also give you an idea of what kind of geopolitical problems are going to erupt from this, which I think we're probably going to see wars and pestilence and crime and brutality and all kinds of things emanating from these financial events. But what I'm going to talk about today is a subject that I have less competence in. However, it is no less important to the overall story that these same people involved in the financial part of this throughout the last couple of hundred years have also been involved in a scientific coup d'etat, if you will allow that that's an analogy to be made here, because this coup that we've been watching over the financial markets and over our geopolitical markets has also been taking place in bioengineered foods, in vaccines, in disease monitoring and control. But in this instance of science, they are using their position of power to push into our lives and into our world a control grid using medical science and using food sciences. Now, the first thing that comes to mind is a company called Monsanto. You can look at Cargill. You can look at Bayer Laboratories. You can look at around the world. And in each instance, you'll find Zionist criminal Jews involved in the leadership or in the scientific process of. You'll find them across the board in our FDA acceptance programs when they're looking into new drugs and processes. You'll find them going back to our research institutes, such as the Rockefeller Institute and many others, and our medical associations, moving us away from known, proven cures for disease that come from our natural world, moving us into sickening chemical solutions for diseases that we may not even have had it not been for these people being in control. So I've brought onto the show different people to address these issues, because my expertise is less than perfect in this area. However, what I tried to do with these guests, and I've asked my guest today to do this for me as well, is point out the connections to the Zionist hierarchy. And names like Strauss come to mind, names like the Rockefellers come to mind, and who they employed, the Flexners and others. And it's been pointed out by, of course, Dr. Nancy T. Banks, a gynecologist and an obstetrics specialist from Harvard, who pointed out that AIDS, of course, was something that looked very suspicious, and all of the evidence pointed to a degenerative disease that is not at all what they have been telling you, and how it has been pushed into our lives through the destruction of our immune system through environmental processes. But today we're going to bring back a recurring guest. Her name is Jennifer Lake. Jennifer has known me for a long time, knows a lot about the French Connection's work, and she's been on her own doing research, trying to bring forward these ideas that these people are out to get us, and the evidence says that they are. So we're going to bring her up right now. Jennifer, are you with me?
Hi, Daryl.
Nice to have you back, Jen. We're in the end game for these guys. It looks like they're bringing in their next wave of political criminals. It doesn't matter if it's going to be the albino dwarf or the communist black man, but in either sense, we're looking toward a new phase in this mess. But it's going to come at a time when science is going to play a big role in what they've got planned, because it looks like they're ramping up either a bird flu of some sort or a new Spanish flu of some sort that was actually generated by these people early on. You want to give us a little background on who generated the first Spanish flu and how this might be described as a bird flu soon or whatever?
Well, I'm happy to do that. What I want to say, though, specifically about disease is that it's a continuum and that it didn't begin with Spanish flu or flu at all. What I really think is going on, and the thing that's been driving my research, is looking at polio, and that polio was this sort of precursing disease, and that this is really where my attention keeps getting funneled, because I find earlier and earlier times for it, and I find that it fits in very, very neatly with the whole rise of Zionism as a political entity.
Well, what kind of time frame are we talking about with the polio research or outbreak or something they started describing as a polio disease? Was that around 1890 through 1920?
Yes, indeed. That's the time. That's the time frame. In fact, in a book called The Polio Paradox, which was written by a doctor named Bruno, he wrote this book to be a manual for polio survivors. But he gave me some very good information about how to start looking. And he had said in his book that a doctor in Britain, a man by the name of William Hirsch, was really the person who collected what polio information there was in this earlier time frame and had defined the disease as brain infection. He called it an encephalitis. That was proven down the road in the 40s by a man who is in the Polio Hall of Fame, a researcher named David Bodian. And he proved through his research that polio was a brain inflammation. It's an infection of the brain stem, and that in all cases of polio, this brain infection exists. And that what's terrifying about polio is that it can be a completely asymptomatic illness. And the statistics on that are that really one in roughly 200 people manifest symptoms. So whatever they say about the caseload of polio, which is very under-acknowledged, and we know that from all the material history that's in the book, you have to take that figure and then multiply it by 200 to even begin to get a grip on how many people were affected by it.
Well, now let's talk for a minute about the move and the push toward vaccine in polio and vaccines in general and how they relate to the disease process, because this has been the response of these people's medical system, the medical system they control. And I want you to know in modern France here, vaccines for every disease known to human beings is being offered. I mean, we've got the papilloma thing over here for young girls. We've got they're telling all these old people to get stuck with the flu thing. And I mean, my point is that it's a hand in hand deal, isn't it? With this, with whatever disease comes up over the parapet, if you'll allow that to be said, they are all of a sudden they've got a new vaccine for it. And in my view, vaccines are dangerous. I understand that people who walk around with herpes and shingles and other common diseases probably got them from the inoculation they received as children.
That's possibly very, very true. I think the evidence is really piling up that that's true. That what happens here is that people are inoculated with long-term infection, and their infection either of a fungal nature, a bacterial nature, a viral nature, whatever you want to call it, they're almost arbitrary in terms of distinguishing what kind of an organism or microbe is responsible for that illness. But pretty much across the board, they do the same kinds of damage. They bear out to be flu-like, interesting enough. This is a blanket kind of term for just about any disease that you want to go look up. That once you manifest a symptom, it's going to come as zoo-like in nature.
Well, I understand that from my own life experience, Jennifer, that, you know, if every one of these diseases carries a fever with it, and many of them carry respiratory distress with it, and many of them carry inflammation with it. And so, and you'll also find those same kind of conditions happening after you get inoculated.
Right.
So, what you're saying to me right now is, it's almost a crisis. A solution is offered, and the solution they're offering is actually sickening the population, and they're selling it to us as the solution. But actually, in fact, it's our own demise that's being given to us, and we're taking it willingly.
Well, we're taking it ignorantly.
Yeah.
To say that. I don't think people are taking it willingly anymore. There's a lot of resistance to getting treated this way now. But in a lot of cases, people are only partially warned, and they don't really understand the basis of why they should resist. And, you know, to me, it goes back to an older idea. There has always been this competing theory in medicine, and it had to do with what was then called something spontaneous generation, which is a very old idea. Aristotle wrote about this. So the Greeks had an understanding of this. And this idea of spontaneous generation is that life forms spring from their basic chemistry. And we're returning to this idea now. This is something that is getting a lot of traction. It has for a long time, and it never did go away. It's been sort of the alternative theory that has been suppressed as much as possible within the established medicine. And since we know that established medicine was something that was almost exclusively promoted by the Rockefeller establishment, it really represents their power in overcoming these other theories. So, you know, they were the major force in the world for pushing this kind of allopathic, pharmaceutical-based medicine on the whole world. And I think it was pretty well established through research that by the 1920s and 30s, that chemistry, in fact, it's chemicals that are the currency of life, and that through some of the things now that I'm contributing to you in articles talking about this, I'm going to bring this up a lot more as we go along, but consider it a completely established fact by 1946 that life forms arise from chemistry, and that a man named Wendell Stanley was given a Nobel Prize in 1946 for having established this as an irrefutable scientific principle.
Well, of course, we know dinonucleic acid and DNA, dinonucleic acid, both of these are chemicals that exhibit themselves in live beings. So we are everything that happens in our lives happens from some reaction chemically.
Right, and it's sort of where you know, this organic chemistry meets the inorganic chemistry, and organic chemistry, as we know it, something that was what they call precipitated. That's an old alchemical term. And experiments had been done, just like the alchemists of old, where by taking atmospheric gases and distilling them by alchemical processes, which is, you know, encapsulating them in a flask and heating them, and through heating and condensing, they were able to create the amino acids that are the basis of organic protein. And this was precipitated out of atmospheric gases. And those are carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen. So we know from these experiments that have been done in this era, this is the foundation of our understanding of how life arises from chemical processes.
Well, now, I want to talk a little bit about something you mentioned to me in an email and then a conversation we had. And nitrogen you brought up as an element part of this organic process. But they're starting to find that in almost every disease process, an acid environment is being discovered, and nitric acid being one of the main acids that is actually tipping organic organisms, or human or otherwise, into disease process, because alkali environments don't support the disease process well. And it's possible that they've been working for a long time at trying to find ways of inflicting an acid or a nitric acid environment upon the human population so that they become susceptible to certain types of diseases that we are now finding described by them as these rare and bizarre AIDS diseases or bird flu diseases or others. And in fact, what it is a destruction of our immune system through an acid process that may in fact be easier to describe in this light. And the reason I'm bringing that up, because ultimately I'd like to start talking about the people who've been pushing this kind of research forward and linking them to some of these criminals. But am I right in making that as a general statement, Jennifer?
Well, yes, you're right. You're right in terms of what's been, that it has an effect. The extent of the effect, I don't really know. But I also know that alkaline situations also produce organisms that are equally toxic and infectious to human beings. So we don't want to tip the scale in the other direction either. This is kind of a weaker part of my own understanding in this.
So what you're saying is that throwing us out of balance is more the goal rather than a necessary acid or alkali environment, but rather putting an excessive strain on one or the other and then ultimately causing a weakening of our immune systems that makes us a host for these degenerative diseases that are becoming a commonplace everywhere. Cancer, of course, all these others. In other words, they've said to me cancer can't survive in a balance, in a pH-balanced body. It gets defeated.
I've heard that too. And I think there's a lot of evidence that's at least a truism. Mm. How completely true that is, I couldn't say. I just don't know.
Well, let's go on then and talk, because your papers and the work you're writing about is going to speak for your deeper research. I'd like the listen, because this is not a classroom for biologists, and it is a group of lay people trying to understand this. So one of the things I'd like to move into here is some of the researchers and their links to this control system that we've found ourselves under the yoke of here. Early on we had a very prominent names that would be recognized today, family names, Rockefeller being one of them, of course, but even others, and you can actually lead them all the way back to some of these large corporations, Monsanto involved, DuPont involved, Bayer, Bayer in America, Bayer, or in England, Bayer involved. In other words, there are links to very serious criminals here. I'm calling them criminals. The corporatists would call them friends. But can you start talking about some of the early researchers and some of their links to this disease process and some of the research they had?
Like I said, I'm looking for a place in time, and I'm looking for something very specific, and that would be, what arose right around the same time that the World Zionist Congress was first started coming together, and Rockefeller, without a doubt, and the whole, the whole network that grew out of that, and that would be John D. Rockefeller Jr. He was the one who directed the family fortune to be spent in this way and applied to medical research. They created an international project, and this was all well in place before World War One.
Were there not eugenicists in his circle of close ties?
Well, eugenicists kind of describe who the Zionists are.
Yep. Yes, it does.
When I look at what happened and who attended these first congresses and what I know about them.
Who are they? Who are some of them, Jen? Give us some names.
One of the co-founders of the Zionist organization, which had its you know, first Congress in Basel, Switzerland, was a man named Max Nordau. Now, Max Nordau served as vice president to Theodor Herzl. He was very close to Herzl. He's attributed with being actually the co-founder. He was the journalistic mouthpiece for the mission statement of the Zionists.
Mm-hmm.
So he really was the person responsible for disseminating this idea and putting it out into print, and also organizing this body of Zionists to become a functioning organization. This is how they made their state within a state. Now, Max Nordau, he had changed his name. His real name was Simcha Sudfeld. He spent his life mostly living in Paris, and he was a practicing physician there. That's what he did. And he turned his attention into psychiatry and mental illness. Now, this is part of where polio ties into this, by the way, because William Hirsch, who publicly criticized the writings of Nordau. Now, what's important to know about Nordau is that he wrote a seminal piece of work called Degeneration. And in this book, thought that he was demonstrating the eugenics principle of the low-minded and the low-born, people who had a disposition to be joyful, be laughing, to fraternize, just be people. He actually came out and tried to convince these Victorian-era people that laughter itself might be the cause of disease.
Laughter might be the cause of disease.
Yes, that laughter could be a cause of disease, that it was a traumatic stress on the body to laugh. Contorted yourself in this process, that you caused your heart to skip, that you might fall down in a convulsion from laughter, that it especially was a contortion of your face, and that took this very strange hack that a face that was predisposed to laughter was an example of someone who had an inferior, potentially criminal mind.
That's as nonsensical as the theories coming out of Sigmund Freud, who was also a rabid Zionist.
Right, but to understand how things work in a Hegelian sense, this doctor William Hirsch came out and took up a critique about Nordau's writing this, and said that actually this type of thing has a physiological basis, and that this is truly how there's a pathology in this kind of mental illness. So amongst the many things that he did, besides taking up the physiological issue of degeneration or generate, he used polio, and that was his incentive to find polio as a neurological disorder. And I think this is where the Zionists really discovered that this was a pathology. It was a disease that already by the evidence of autopsy that they had been able to determine that polio was a disease that would infect the brain and would literally kill off the neurological structures within the brain. So if we're looking for malice aforethought, if we're looking for an original agent that could be used as a bioweapon, I think polio was that thing.
Now, we also find people that you mentioned to me in the past, as this began to come to life, this idea, we see people in America named, one of them is Strauss, you brought up. The Strauss family being all over this, and also the Flexners having monopolistically controlled information both arriving and leaving on the subject of polio. You want to talk a little bit about their role and how this whole conspiracy, because it is a conspiracy, it's showing itself as one, actually started to develop here and with these names?
right. Well, we need to understand something about polio. We can use this for a perfect example. Polio is the most studied of all viruses, and it comes from a family of virus that is the smallest, and it exists and flourishes in the human intestine. So the premise that I'm going for is to understand how, just by ingesting it, this becomes the most infectious of agents, and that they knew at the time, in the 1890s, by this time, they knew what kind of neurological damage it could do. And what appeared to become a very important program of Zionists was to control food and to pasteurize food. And a lot of reasons for this. Now, something we've mentioned and you have brought up to me in conversation is the multi-use purpose that a weapon can be, the broader spectrum it can take as far as its weapons application.
Well, yes. Let me try to see. I mean, when these people come up with an idea to do something and it's going to benefit them, let's say in the infecting or sickening of a population, they also are smart enough to try to make money off of it, and then also use it as a way of frightening the public or use it as a way of making public policy. In other words, there's never a single goal. It's always multifaceted, and it's always very hard to pinpoint what the real cause and effect is of their decision. But the fact is that they're making, they actually use this system that they've built up to finance their own the destruction of their target group. They destroy us with our own policy.
Yeah.
It's amazing that they get away with that. But yes, of course. And with the pasteurization of milk, well, pasteurization in general is it weakens our ability to fight off disease because it pasteurizing something destroys the vitamins in it and the good bacteria. And so basically what we're doing is sterilizing our food.
Yes, you're right. Well, if you want to, you know, sort of the idea that fighting fire with fire, if you want to control bacteria and fungi in your system, the best way to do that is with other bacteria and fungi. This is kind of a standard when it comes to the microflora in the intestine. So if you can effectively get people to accept that they should not be ingesting the bacteria and fungi that would inhabit their intestines, you make the intestinal tract weak, unable to defend itself against other invading bacteria and fungi, and you do something else. If you can convince mothers not to breastfeed the children, then they lose their ability to develop a mature intestinal tract, because these bacteria play an essential role in allowing the intestinal system to develop. So in a sense, they have an immature gut for the rest of their lives. And they, through all kinds of research, I've been looking at what they've learned from mice. Mice will have chronic colitis. There's, of course, a host of intestinal disorders that people get when they can't adequately colonize gut bacteria. So this completely can disarm the human system. To have a failure of the intestines be able to properly handle and manage the incoming bacteria and things that we normally would get just from the environment. So this is a big, big issue. To me, you know, the nutshell story here is that if they knew this, and they also knew that the neurological damage that could cause by an agent such as polio, that polio could colonize in the gut, and polio then would be overcoming immature microflora of a human that was not actually raised on the proper food that would cause an adequate amount of development there.
Well, now, let's move on from that premise into the people doing it, Jen. The people involved, because we've given us good science lesson here.
Well, this is, you know, just essential to lay the groundwork, what makes this all so ominous?
Well, I mean, I think we have a good grasp of that. Let's talk a little bit about who these people were at the time. I mentioned the Strauss group, but the Flexners, of course, come to mind. Were there others that you came upon?
Well, yeah, there are others, you know, by name, looking into AIDS and, you know, things that have now come by association to having laid the groundwork for that.
Well, you looked into the Spanish flu as well, and you found some very strange anomalies in that. And they were connections to the, actually, to the polio and other things. But what other things have you been able to track back to this group? And what centers were they working out of? You mentioned to me Chicago, University of Chicago was one of them, was it not?
Well, University of Chicago was one of the institutions that was a big part of the Manhattan Project.
Yeah.
So if we think about medicine as being a forerunning Manhattan Project, you look primarily to the New York Health Establishment as being central to having this disseminate into the world. What I learned from doing Spanish flu research was that the New York Health Establishment laid the foundation for what became the National Institute of Health, that it was modeled after this program. And this is all very meaningful. This is what makes this whole thing boil down to just a handful of people. Nathan Strauss, who had been on this pasteurization campaign beginning in 1893, when he really got wheels going here for this, in 1898, he was the New York City Health Commissioner. This was his job. So this man was not a doctor. He had no medical training of any kind, and yet because of politics, because of his philanthropy, his so-called altruism, he was able to sit at the top of this New York City establishment of health.
But what we find, Jennifer, is there was no altruistic intent at all, but rather some very sinister intent if you start digging through the evidence.
Well, that's it. That's the understory. You know, because of an article I put up for you, Daryl, called The Ruination of Milk.
Yeah.
What I demonstrated in that was that the whole pasteurization campaign rode on the heels of cleaning up the water supply in New York, and that they took claim over their successes in a complete parallel timing with the improvements that were made in the city's water system. So this is how the propaganda is made and generated. And they got away with that. They successfully got away with saying it. So, you know, establishing patterns then comes the norm here.
Were there ties between people like Morgenthau and people like Baruch and Strauss out of New York? Because it seems like all of the movers and shakers of this early criminal Zionist movement were hand in glove with each other, regardless of what element within the structure they were working, whether it be geopolitics or whether it be destabilizing the Russian nation and turning it into a communist nation, and in other words, they were actually people who put things into action. You know, earlier, 50 years, 60 years earlier, the writers of the Communist Manifesto from the same community were writing the dogma. Now the dogma was actually being put into practice, and it was these New York Zionist Jews that were putting the rubber to the road, if you will, on most of these organizations' criminal actions.
Right. Well, they were very personally connected, if not professionally. When I was investigating the Strauss family, the grandchildren of Nathan Strauss, Oscar and Isidore Strauss, attended private Hebrew school with the children of Morgenthau and others. So when you go far enough where you learn something about the personal history, you realize that they had all their personal links in place.
Yes.
Also,